We have two matters on the 130 docket today, and the first one is People Against Jones. I assume counsel seated at council table are here on that case, and it doesn't look as though counsel is here on the second matter, so that's not a problem because we have to take a break afterward and make a substitution on our panel. We have read the briefs in this case. At least one of us has been into the record, so we're well aware of the facts. And if that helps you in streamlining your presentation, so be it. You have 15 minutes aside. The yellow light comes on when 5 minutes are remaining to allow you to plan for rebuttal if that's what you wish. I would ask that everyone turn off pagers and cell phones so that we're not interrupted during the course of the oral arguments. And with that request, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Lynn Nessner, attorney registration 39209. I'm here on behalf of the defendant appellant, Ms. Jones. Today, I would like to focus on the first two issues raised in the opening brief regarding the trial court's failure to give the defendant's theory of defense instruction and the court's erroneous instruction on the initial aggressor doctrine. As part of a defendant's fundamental right to present a defense, a defendant is entitled to have the jury instructed on her theory of the case. In People v. Nunes, the Colorado Supreme Court held that a district court must give the defendant's theory of defense instruction where there is any evidence to support it, i.e., the court has an obligation to tender the instruction because it is for the jury, not the court, to determine the truth of the defendant's theory. As part of this duty or obligation, the district court also has an obligation to work with defense counsel if the court doesn't approve of the theory of defense instruction and tailor it or incorporate it into another instruction. Here, the district court completely ignored its affirmative duty to either tender the instruction or cooperate with counsel. The requested theory of defense instructions serve two very important purposes critical to the defense. It informed the jury how to evaluate reasonableness, defining reasonableness as a subjective standard based on Mrs. Jones' situation and circumstances. And it directed the jury to consider Mr. Rice's prior acts of violence in determining the reasonableness of Mrs. Jones' beliefs and actions. This was not a misstatement of the law. The Colorado Supreme Court case Sanchez v. People provides authority for this instruction, as well as for a subjective standard of reasonableness. It held that the fact finder must consider a reasonable person, how a reasonable person would act under similar circumstances.
Ms. Nessner, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
As I understand your position, even though the defendant was acquitted of second-degree murder, your theory is that the self-defense instruction was in error, or your theory of defense instruction wasn't properly given. And since it wasn't, the defendant wouldn't have been convicted of reckless manslaughter, and the initial aggressor instruction goes to that theory. Is that right? I mean, I guess my question is the initial aggressor instruction, is that still an issue for you if the second degree murder charge resulted in an acquittal?
Both instructional errors, I think, are still at issue, even though she was convicted only of reckless manslaughter, because although self-defense is not an affirmative defense to reckless manslaughter, it still serves as a complete and general defense because it negates the mens rea.
And that was your theory of defense?
Yes.
Even to the charge of reckless manslaughter?
Yes, across the board, that our theory was that Miss Jones acted reasonably based on, like, the history of domestic abuse.
We're on the same page. I confirm my understanding.
Okay. There was ample evidence that supported the tendering of the theory of defense instruction. There's a history of domestic disputes between the couple. Several neighbors had testified to hearing fighting in the apartment. And in fact, a week or two before the incident, Mr. Rice had thrown Ms. Jones against the wall. And Ms. Jones told the police about this, and this was corroborated by a neighbor's testimony. Evidence of Mr. Rice's prior violent acts goes directly to the reasonableness of the defendant's belief regarding the imminence of danger, as well as the degree of force necessary to protect herself. The theory of defense instruction was not embodied in other instructions. None of the instructions specifically explained how to evaluate reasonableness. None of them informed the jury that they should use a subjective standard. None of the instructions specifically apprised the jury that they shouldn't use their common sense to decide what they would reasonably do in the situation, or what a neutral, objective person would do or think, but rather they should consider what was reasonable for Ms. Jones to believe, given the history of violence and her knowledge that Mr. Rice was strong enough to throw her against the wall and had done so. This isn't a harmless error because Mrs. Jones' defense hinged on the reasonableness of her beliefs and actions. Mr. Rice was shaking her and grabbing her and cornering her when she grabbed the knife. Was that a reasonable action? I mean, this is what the jury had to decide. It becomes more reasonable when you focus on her subjective perception and knowledge. Thus, had the jury been instructed specifically to consider this evidence, they might have acquitted her. Because evidence supported giving this instruction, the district court committed reversible error by rejecting it and not making any effort to work with counsel to tailor it. As to the second issue, the initial aggressor instruction, the district court erred in giving this instruction because there wasn't an adequate evidentiary basis. The court gave this instruction because there was evidence that Ms. Jones may have initiated the verbal fight, that she might have said the first angry words. However, to warrant an instruction on this principle, which limits self-defense, there must be some evidence that the defendant initiated the physical contact. It is well settled that words alone do not make an individual the initial aggressor. Here, there was absolutely no evidence that Ms. Jones was the first person to initiate the physical contact.
Counsel, given the fact that she was, same question Judge Graham asked, given the fact that she was acquitted of the murder charge, and the initial aggressor instruction was given as part of the package of instructions relating to the affirmative defense, self-defense to murder. Why is it still relevant? Why do we have to even deal with the initial aggressor instruction vis-a-vis the reckless manslaughter case, conviction?
Because in instruction 18, the jury was instructed that, and this is based on subsection 4 of the self-defense statute, which supersedes the cases that the Attorney General relies on in his answer brief, but in subsection 4 of the self-defense statute, it says that the court must instruct on self-defense, even in cases where self-defense is not an affirmative defense. And in accordance with that statute, here in instruction 18, the jury was instructed that they may consider evidence of self-defense. And if they find that the degree of force Ms. Jones used was justified, they could not find that she acted recklessly. Well, if they found that she was the initial aggressor, if they were confused by this instruction on the initial aggressor doctrine, then they could not find that she was justified in using that degree of force, and therefore, like, they could have been misled as to whether they could find her reckless. I mean, all the instructions regarding self-defense still need to be correct, even though it's reckless manslaughter, because self-defense would negate, it's still a complete defense to reckless manslaughter. If they found that she acted in self-defense, they couldn't find that she acted recklessly because self-defense assumes reasonable, knowing conduct. Recklessness and self-defense are inconsistent.
Although the trial court instructed the jury here that words and insults alone don't make a person an initial aggressor, so the jury was properly instructed regarding that.
But why give two instructions if none was warranted? I mean, I think that only served to further, confuse or mislead the jury. I mean, why have them resolve an issue if there is no issue?
That's your position. I mean, assuming for a moment that there's not one scintilla of evidence to support an initial aggressor instruction. Yes, I understand that.
That would be my position. I mean, the trial court gave the initial aggressor instruction based on Michelle Castillo's testimony. That is Mr. Rice's ex-girlfriend, and she testified that on the night of the incident, Mr. Rice called her and asked her to come pick him up, and in the background she could hear Miss Jones, you know, her voice was angry and combative. And so the court found that based on this evidence, the jury could infer that Miss Jones started the argument, but not necessarily the physical fight. I mean, Miss Castillo did not hear, you know, Miss Jones hit Mr. Rice during the phone call.
Well, he was talking and the phone went dead.
I think his voice changed and then he was like, I have to go. You know, it wasn't like the phone suddenly went dead. He was like, he abruptly got off the phone. But I mean, he was calling his ex-girlfriend on her phone. You know, I feel like any girlfriend would be angry if they found their boyfriend calling the ex-girlfriend, you know, on their phone. So, I mean, it could have just been that he was sort of caught talking to the ex-girlfriend. I mean, that doesn't necessarily show that then she hit him. This is distinguishable from a case like People v. Roadcap, where one of the witnesses saw the defendant grab the victim. I mean, here the state didn't put forth any evidence that Miss Jones was the one that hit Mr. Rice initially. If anything, the evidence would show that Mr. Rice may have been the one that initiated the fight because he had a history of getting violent and he was heavily intoxicated on the night of the incident. So, by instructing on this abstract principle of law, and even if the court, you know, tried to sort of mitigate the confusion by giving the words alone don't justify initial aggressor instruction, it still potentially misled the jury because this issue was put in front of them. It didn't really have a basis in the facts or the record. And it may have deprived her of her defense and her acquittal because the prosecution characterized her as the attacker in the closing argument, and the jury may have thought that, you know, she was the initial aggressor because they got this instruction on that, and they may have found that she was not justified then and that she acted recklessly and self-defense wasn't available to her. So under these circumstances, it cannot be considered harmless error. Based on these instructional errors, we would ask the court to reverse and save the rest for rebuttal.
Got about 2.5 minutes, Ms. Nesner.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee, registration number 38141, on behalf of the people. I'd like to make 3 points this afternoon. First, on the reasonableness instruction. Under Darby, the defendant's argument fails, and that's case cited in the people's brief. The self-defense instructions here, as explained in Darby, encompass the defendant's tendered instruction. The jury was instructed that defendant was justified in using physical force to defend herself if she reasonably believed the degree of force was necessary. They were also given instruction 9, which told the jury to consider all of the evidence in evaluating the defendant's self-defense claim. Those instructions, as set forth in Darby, were adequate to apprise the jury of the defendant's tender instruction. So what we have here is completely opposed to the case in Nunez that the defendant relies upon, which is a case involving an alibi instruction. That was error in that case because none of the instructions encompassed the tendered theory of defense. Rather, as this court explained in Inman, which is also cited in the People's Brief, the trial court, as a matter of law, should reject a defendant's theory of the case instruction if it merely restates a point stated in the other instructions, which is clearly what it does here. Also, a court should reject instruction if it merely just emphasizes certain evidence, which is here in regards to the tendered instructions, description of the fact that they should consider the victim's prior acts of violence against the defendant in construing whether the defendant reasonably acted. In addition to being incorrect as a matter of law, going through the briefs and preparing for oral argument, I also don't know if it was proper as a matter of fact. There wasn't really any evidence that there were prior acts of violence of the victim against the defendant. In the briefs, the defendant primarily relies upon evidence from the neighbors that they heard fighting inside the apartment. But there was nothing to suggest that this wasn't mutual, that it was specifically the victim attacking the defendant. Even under the defendant's second police report, where she talked about being hit by the defendant earlier that day, that only related to that day. So there was no basis in the evidence to suggest that there were these previous prior acts of violence. So as a matter of law and as a matter of fact, the instruction was properly refused. On the second point I'd like to make regarding the initial aggressor instruction, the defendant appears to argue that a trial court can only give an initial aggressor limitation to self-defense instruction if someone testifies and actually physically observed the defendant initiate physical contact. But this court's cases simply haven't drawn that line. And I'm going to disagree with defense counsel's reading of ROCAP because I think that case is the most parallel case to what we have here. In ROCAP, the defendant testified that he and his wife got, or he and another woman got in a fight inside the house. She chased him outside, she grabbed a gardening tool, and then he killed her in self-defense. The court tendered initial aggressor instruction and on appeal, they raised the same claim that they raised here. This court found that because a neighbor had testified that they saw the defendant go in the house, go out to the gardening shed, and come back in, the jury could have inferred that when he went out to the shed, he got a tool and then attacked the victim inside. And that's, I think, part and parcel with the facts we have here. So the proper standard is what this court explained in Beasley. And it's a simple, straightforward question of whether looking at the evidence as a whole in the light most favorable to the people, was there some evidence that the defendant was the initial aggressor? And here there were two sources of evidence, either individually and especially cumulatively, which would have supported the instruction. First, as pointed out in the brief, one of the neighbors testified that she heard the victim scream, "The bitch is going to cut my hands off." Certainly, based on that evidence, the jury could have inferred that the defendant was the initial aggressor. Although the defendant argues that words alone do not make a person initial aggressor, there's a fundamental distinction between that and what we have here. The jury would have found that she was not the initial aggressor because she threw out angry words. What we have here is someone using words to describe a physical action, an initial aggressive action, and that's enough for the instruction. Additionally, as this court pointed out, as the trial court relied upon, there's also evidence that right before the stabbing, the victim was talking on the phone with his other girlfriend, and they heard the defendant screaming, and all of a sudden the phone call ended abruptly. Based on that, the jury also could have inferred that the defendant had done something to have caused that phone call to have ended so abruptly. Final point on that issue I'd like to make, I think as Judge Graham and Judge Richman pointed out, I think arguably that the initial aggressor instruction might be moot, just in the fact that the initial aggressor limitation applies to both the second degree murder charge and the reckless manslaughter charge. The fact that the jury acquitted the defendant of reckless manslaughter would seem to suggest that they didn't view the defendant as initial aggressor. They didn't find that she forfeited her right to self-defense because she was initial aggressor. So arguably, I think given the case and the facts we have here, the claim might be moot.
Yes, Mr. Lee, as I understand Ms. Nesner's argument, given the acquittal of the second-degree murder charge, her argument is that since the self-defense instruction was necessary and she was entitled to it, it was confusing to give the initial aggressor instruction with that self-defense instruction there as well, since it tends to negate the self-defense considerations of reasonableness for the reckless manslaughter charge. But it is correct, is it not, that in closing argument, defense counsel had a chance to argue that initial aggressor instruction?
Defense counsel or the prosecutor?
Defense counsel.
Defense counsel? Oh, argued that she was not the initial aggressor.
Yes.
Yes. And in fact, I think she might have. I mean, the theory of defense was that she was not the initial aggressor.
Right.
So yes, of course, this court can look at closing argument to see in evaluating whether the jury was properly instructed. And I think given defense counsel's closing argument and the fact that I don't think the prosecutor really harped on the fact that the defendant forfeited her right because she was the initial aggressor, there's no, any error was harmless. Especially given the fact that, you know, the prosecution's theory was that the defendant was the aggressor. Not that she forfeited her right because she started it, but just that she was the aggressor and she killed the victim without any cause. Especially given the funds of evidence here, I don't think any instructional error is harmless. Which gives me to my third point, and that's just simply that any error here had to have been harmless given the fact that based on the defendant's own testimony, she recklessly killed the victim. In her second police report, she explained that she didn't intend to kill the victim, she only wanted to nick him. That means she didn't intend to stab him, she didn't intend to kill him, she just wanted to nick him. That's reckless manslaughter. I mean, by her own account, by her own terms, that's reckless manslaughter. Especially when we consider that in the context of self-defense. Self-defense presupposes that someone intended to do the act, intended to use that amount of force, and they subjectively believed that amount of force was necessary to protect themselves. Here, she didn't think she had to kill him. She didn't mean to kill him. So, as a matter of law, subjectively, she, based on her own words, she was not acting in reasonable self-defense in killing the victim.
Would you contend that that statement itself, just wanted to nick him, would also support an initial aggressor instruction?
I haven't thought about that, but yes. Based on that statement, the jury could have disregarded her other statements and felt that that was the initial contact. If the court has no further questions, I'd ask you to affirm the defense conviction and the judgment of the court below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Ms. Nesner?
First, this case is distinguishable from People v. Darby, which is a Colorado Court of Appeals case that the Attorney General relies upon. In that case, the defense requested a theory of defense instruction, and the court tendered half of the instruction. They just cut out the portion that related to domestic violence as a It explained domestic violence was not in and of itself a defense to a crime. But they were still, the jury in that case was instructed that the defendant's defense is that she acted in defense of herself due to repeated physical, verbal, and mental abuse, which reasonably caused her to act in self-defense. So in that case, they did receive much of the theory of defense instruction, and there was a lot more evidence of domestic violence put on so that the court found that the jury was apprised of domestic violence and knew that it was an issue. So the portion of the theory of defense instruction wasn't necessary. And I'd also like to dispute the Attorney General's assumption that a theory of defense instruction should not be given. In fact, in Nunes, the presumption is that if there's any evidence, it should be given, and the trial court should work with defense counsel to incorporate the defense. This wasn't just a mere restatement. Nowhere in the instructions does it say, evidence of Mr. Rice's prior violent acts influence the reasonableness, or should influence your consideration of the reasonableness of Ms. Jones' beliefs and actions. And it was supported by facts that there was previous violence.
Are you referring to the neighbor's testimony?
Yes, there was a neighbor, Randy Nimeroff, who said, you know, he heard a thumping on the wall, and this corresponds with when Ms. Jones said that Mr. Rice had thrown her against the wall, and her son had seen that. And Randy Nimeroff heard, like, a thump so loud that a pitcher fell off his wall. So it was corroborated that previously he had thrown her against the wall. The evidence does support the tendering of this instruction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nesner. Thank you, Mr. Lee. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. We're going to take a